Warning, Weird West Radio contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
See, in this world, there's two kinds of people, my friend. Those with loaded guns, and those who dig. You dig.
All right, hello, welcome everyone to Weird West Radio, Rayman Digital's exclusive Western show, where we get into all types of Westerns, whether it be traditional, weird, spaghetti Westerns at times. I am Michael, your host. If you're new to our show, you can find us pretty much wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search Weird West Radio. Today in the studio with me to discuss some Westerns is David.
Howdy.
This episode here officially starts our 2024 podcast season for Weird West Radio. And I figured that the most logical first step in our season is to set a path for the year, to discuss everything that's coming out this year when it comes to the Western genre, the Western film. And David, surprisingly, and I say it kind of with a question mark because we're entering a weird era of Westerns, but surprisingly, there's a lot yes. on the slate this year to come out.
Almost like Westerns have kind of going through a mini resurgence of like films and stuff, and TV products are coming out.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in the world of Western films, and I am okay with that. I'm happy. I don't think having 7 or 8 major Western films is a negative. I know some people get nervous when a genre either becomes popular or becomes popular again, because then it paves the way for exploitation and poor, shoddy versions of those films. But listen, we're very far away from entering that territory of exploitation when it comes to the Western film.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about the biggest news for this year when it comes to Westerns. And I think most Western fans, David, would agree. And if you don't agree, Dave, then please say you don't. But I think the biggest Western news for 2024 is Kevin Costner's upcoming epic.
Yes, it has to be.
That's the hallmark film of 2024 when it comes to Westerns, correct?
Yes, especially since it is really considered one of the biggest gambles for a filmmaker in the industry right now, because Kevin Costner essentially, because he chose to do this new Western, and I say this with a caveat that basically doesn't mean that he can't go back, but essentially, he shut down a production of a very lucrative and well-received television product like Yellowstone.
Yeah.
And everyone's like saying, you go from that and you're taking a gamble on a feature film. And it's very reminiscent of like what he did what he's done in the past, especially like when people start throwing things like Waterworld out there. And this is a little different. I think Kevin Costner knows what he's doing. And I think that this is a good time for him to make this quote unquote gamble.
Yeah. Yeah. The gamble is large, David. It's over $100 million is what it cost for the first two films, which is relatively inexpensive in this era of inflated budgets. But still, for one man to front the cost, that's a lot of dough, because this is, for all intents and purposes, this is an indie picture. It's being produced and financed by Kevin Costner. And interesting enough, David, he said in an interview that he had two choices at this point in his life. Either continue to try to get this movie made, because a lot of studios didn't want to make this movie based on their own financial projections and analysis. They didn't feel like a movie like this belongs in this current climate, meaning it wasn't going to be a hugely successful, profitable film in their eyes, in their opinion, based on their own market research. So Kevin Costner grew tired of waiting and decided to put his own money into it. And he has said that he had two choices at this point in his life. He said, either I can sit on property I own in my life, in my later years, as I sit and retire and get older, or I can mortgage that property that's just sitting there that I was going to use for my retirement and use it to make a movie. And he said that instead of using this land that I sold for my old age, I decided to use it to make a movie that I've been trying to make. Apparently, he's been on this journey for 30 years.
Yeah, this is like, honestly, I think, and the movie is called Horizon, Horizon, an American Saga. And me as a filmmaker really appreciates the story of how Horizon is being made, because it's kind of like, it is that filmmaker's dream to say, you know, everyone's telling me not to make this film, but damn it all to hell, I'm going to do it regardless.
Well, the last time he did this, it did fail miserably.
Yes.
And it was Waterworld, which is still, I believe, considered one of the largest financial catastrophes in modern cinema history.
But I appreciate the attempt at Waterworld too, because
for sure.
It's kind of like, as an artist, as an artist, you're like going, well, I could either sit on my laurels and not do anything, or I'm going to go out there and I'm still going to actually do my trade, my craft.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see someone actually do that, yeah, it's a huge gamble. I mean, that's a lot of money to actually just throw away onto a film that you might not make. Most likely, you're not going to make the money back on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll see how it pans out. You know, you bring up Yellowstone and the controversy behind the scenes on that set. Basically, and this is all hearsay, there's been a few actual reports, so take this as a grain of salt, but there was a lot of butting heads of ego, basically, between Taylor Sheridan and Kevin Costner.
Are we surprised?
And I believe a lot of it has to do with this ownership of the Western genre. For the past 8 years, Taylor Sheridan has been continually pointed to as the singular force that has brought back the Western in a big way.
Yeah.
Pretty much everything he's made is a Western. Even when it's a contemporary film, it has the Western flair, yes, all over it. Then fast forward through various films he's made, and let's take us now to Yellowstone. Yellowstone has completely flabbergasted television analysis, or I should say, television analysis and people who study television and the television landscape, because Yellowstone is doing things that other TV shows cannot manage any longer in this current fragmented environment when it comes to content, meaning Yellowstone is a water cooler show.
Yeah.
Everybody's watching it. Everyone's talking about it. And that's extremely hard to create when we have 27,000 entities all creating multiple original shows. So that's one of the reasons people are pointing to as to why there was this controversy, because Kevin Costner could have been patient and waited for Yellowstone to end. If this is his money that he's using, there was no timetable on the financing. He could at any point sell that property, use that money to produce and shoot this film. But he chose to do it instead of continuing with Yellowstone, which says there is an ego there. There is something to be said about that in this entire equation.
Yes.
Now, moving beyond that, the writer mentions that the four film saga, not two, the four film saga, is by far the biggest struggle for him, says the writer director, when no one wanted to make the first one. He's like, I got the bright idea to make four. Now, interestingly, how it's going to work is we already will get, without a doubt, two films. So it's a four-part theatrical epic written and directed by Kevin Costner. Only two films are guaranteed, with the other two hinging on the success of the first group of releases. So that's why I keep advocating, go see the movie. If you guys want to see these types of pictures being made in the theater, go see these movies. If you want to support independent cinema, go see these movies. Yes. If you want directors and producers to go off grid or to break ranks with the studio conglomerates, give them the middle finger and say, there are other ways to make my picture. go see this movie.
Yes.
These are the types of films, if we are against what the studios are doing currently, whether it be because of the culture wars or just the overall poor quality, this is when we support these types of movie.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, like, when it comes to like films like this, this is the only way nowadays a film like this is going to be made. Because just like what we've alluded to earlier, production houses nowadays, like the big studios, are not going to take gambles. They want surefire hits.
Yeah, I made a mistake. The budget is not $100 million. The two films added $100 million into the economy of Utah because of where it shot. You know, tax write-offs, the fact that you're bringing work to the state. I don't actually know what the actual budget is, per se. I don't know if it's been released yet. David, do you know?
I have no idea what it costs, but like, I think that basically Horizon, because of what Kevin Costner had to put into this film, and especially since he's budgeting like four films, essentially.
Okay, so here's the basics here. So Costner has invested at least $20 million of his own money into the Horizon movies. He also deferred most of his salary in order to fund the two movies.
Yes. Because that was the biggest thing too, is like, he's not wanting to get paid. He just wants to get this movie done. And that's the story that I really like, is like, as a filmmaker, he's making that sacrifice and saying, hey, I know I'm not going to get anything out of this. The only satisfaction he's getting out of this is the fact that it's going to get done. And I think at the core, that's like something that harkens to all of us as filmmakers, is like, it's amazing to me when people say, well, why do you do the filming that you do, Dave? And I look at him and says, well, I do it because I just want to. I just want to. I don't care about, like, you know, how much money I'm going to make. It might cost me actually a lot of money that I have currently just to do a film. But like, I still want to do it. It's kind of like the old adage of like when people ask people, why do you climb Mount Everest? And people basically said, well, it's there. That's filmmaking. That's like the core element I always feel about filmmaking, is like what Kevin Costner is saying is like, hey, I'm just getting older and older every year, and I'm never going to be able to get this picture done with the help of others. So I'm going to just force it by my sheer will.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And do it, get the film done.
Yeah, that's what you got to do. David, I was able to track down some of the financials. So according to court documents, Costner's salary for acting, producing, and directing was $12 million for both movies. The star deferred most of his salary for the duo. However, meaning Costner put around $20 million of his own money into Horizon, as I mentioned. And according to the New York Times or the New York Post, the star also mortgaged, as I mentioned, a valuable 10-acre plot of land he owns in Santa Barbara, California, to help fund the films. So taking all that into account, the New York Post states that Costner is thought to have personally raised about $50 million for the Horizon movie so far.
Which is essentially an indie film.
Oh, absolutely is. You know what? If he can't make a good movie for, let's say, $50 million, then he shouldn't be making movies. Because when you have directors like Gareth Edwards putting out The Creator for $80 million,
yes,
and you have the gentleman that did Godzilla Minus One for under $20 million, you can make a Western for $50 million. Yes. You could probably make two really substantially large-looking pictures for $50 million.
And that's the thing I think sometimes gets lost with movie fans.
Yeah.
It's only $50 million. And they're comparing what he's putting up compared to what a studio can put up.
Oh, yeah.
A studio can put up like $100 million without a blink of an eye. And that's a small budget for a studio. But for an indie filmmaker, that is basically a lifetime's worth of salary. Like, it's really difficult to raise that type of collateral as a filmmaker unless you have the pull of, say, like a, as funny as it sounds, like an Adam Sandler. Adam Sandler can make movies constantly without any fear of if it's bad or not, but it doesn't matter because he's constantly just churning them out.
Yeah.
And for indie filmmaker like how Kevin Costner has to approach this, because Kevin Costner doesn't have that collateral. The most collateral he's got as a name is Yellowstone.
Yeah.
That's
which,
it.
Which he's probably made a lot of money.
He's made a lot of money on
that series.
But if you think about it, when you have to look at the game in Hollywood of what's your assets that you got behind your name, he doesn't have much outside of Yellowstone that's at least within the last, what would you say, 10 years?
Yeah, I think what you're trying to say is a lot of people think because you're a celebrity, you're a star, you've been in movies, that you just have liquid.
You have liquid.
You don't.
That's not how the game works.
$50 million is a lot of fucking money for anyone.
Yes.
Except maybe Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos.
That's probably just like a sneeze.
Yeah. Yeah, but I like Costner's whole general, like, philosophical attitude towards the making of this movie.
I do too.
His general view on Hollywood currently. I mean, he says we have a lot of Westerns that aren't good, too, because they get simplified. But this isn't Disneyland. These are real lives, people just making their way, women just trying to keep their families clean. And of course, he's talking about his movie and fed. I'm drawn to that. I'm always going to get to my gunfight, but I'm drawn to the little things that people had to endure. So to me, Horizon was worth holding on to because I just felt like I wanted to tell it. It grew and it grew and it grew until suddenly I realized that I just had to make it. And I had to look to myself financially to do it, which is not the smartest thing, but I count on the movie speaking louder than anything I can say. He has a lot of confidence in this film.
Oh, yeah. Well, especially since we all know that Kevin Costner is very passionate about the Western genre. And the core stereotype of the Western, especially in American Westerns, is kind of like that perseverance. It's that Western idea that basically we're going to, you know, conquer the West throughout history, right? And that's what Kevin Costner is really tying to. And that, I think that's why when you look at a lot of his films have that central core theme, whether it's Waterworld, Postman, I'm trying to think of it, Wyatt Earp. There's that core element that basically
a lot of people hate on that movie. I don't get it.
Wyatt Earp, you know, it's not one of my favorite Westerns, but it's a good Western.
I think the problem with that movie is it came out too close to Tombstone.
That was the problem. And Tombstone is the perfect Western for mass audiences. Wyatt Earp is honestly made for an indie film crowd.
Yeah.
Because of how nuanced and character driven it is.
That's the difference between Earp and, is it Earp or Wyatt Earp? I always forget Earp. The name. Is it Earp? Yeah. Between, you know, Kevin Costner's Wyatt Earp story and Kurt Russell's. Kurt Russell's is amazing. Tombstone will always be one of my favorite Westerns.
Oh, absolutely.
But it isn't entirely deep. If you look at Kevin Costner's movie, his story, it's a little more nuanced.
And it talks about the depth of what Wyatt Earp as a person went through.
Yeah.
Tombstone was kind of like an action film. Think of it kind of like Predator and I think
both have their merits.
Yeah, both have their merits. They're just told different ways.
Yeah.
And one just so happened to be more tailored for one audience in movies, which is the mass audiences, which is Tombstone, compared to Wyatt Earp, which I felt was like tailor-made for indie crowds because of how narratively driven it is. Because it is a deep film. And when you think about it, like what he mentioned in that article, how he likes stories that really dive deep into a person's struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Wyatt Earp. Wyatt Earp was a 2.5-hour epic of how this guy started at the bottom and then became a legend. Same. And it's like, okay, this is what Costner likes. And unfortunately, during that time, you know, audiences weren't ready for that. I think audiences are ready for Horizon because it goes back to like why Taylor Sheridan's shows and particularly in Yellowstone, why audiences gravitate towards it, because there's so much depth with those characters that they do in those shows. To be able to see something like that in Horizon is very interesting. I hope he gets the same magic.
I hope it connects with the audiences because been a lot of negative PR surrounding this movie because of the behind the scenes antics between Taylor Sheridan and Kevin Costner. A lot of people were upset with both of them because their differences couldn't be resolved. For the fans.
But if you think about it.
And I'm one of those people. I'm a little annoyed with both of them. I love both of those guys.
Yeah.
I understand the nature of business and I get egos and pounding chests and peacocking. I get it. But at the end of the day, they both should have come to an agreement and say, listen, we have a great thing going here with Yellowstone. The fans love it. It is one of the most talked about shows currently on television, not streaming, but on actual television. We should probably try to squash our differences so we can give to the fans. The fans are the reason why this show has been successful. It's the reason why there's been multiple spinoffs. It's the reason why Sheridan has a career.
Yes.
It's the reason why Kevin Costner has garnered
a resurgence,
has had a resurgence. That's a negative. And a lot of articles are in fact discussing that when promoting both Yellowstone's final season as well as Kevin Costner's Horizon. I'm hoping that negativity doesn't drown this film's potential success.
I hope so too, because like there's a lot of potential here for Horizon to be a surprise hit to the point where basically we could be talking Oscars with Kevin Costner next year.
Yeah.
If Horizon's that good.
Well, dude, even financial success, it could happen if Costner is able to connect with that Yellowstone audience in his marketing for Horizon, his movie will breeze past expectations, financially speaking.
And the thing I would tell fans that, especially who listen to our show and stuff, when it comes to the fight and the quote-unquote drama between Sheridan and Costner, me and you have covered both people extensively in this network. It's kind of a surprise that Sheridan and Costner got along well with each other. Since the beginning.
Yeah.
But like,
even their worldviews are extremely different. Their worldviews
are so different. And yeah, it's amazing we've gotten Yellowstone up to this point. But it's kind of like, are we surprised that at the end of the day, they just had to amicably part? It's not a surprise to me.
Yeah. I just find it silly how people can never squash differences. You guys both have a moneymaker. You have the fucking golden goose. Yeah, and you guys are worrying about your egos.
Yeah.
Relax. And all, let's reap the benefits. You reap the money. The fans get what they want. It's a win-win. How the fuck can you not just fucking relax? Chill out.
The one thing I would have, I was like thinking about to myself with when I first heard Horizon was being made, was at first, before the beef, I thought, oh, Sheridan's going to actually probably have some say in Horizon and help Kevin Costner out since Costner's been in Yellowstone. And it's like their egos could not make that work.
Yeah. And they're both capable directors and writers. The difference is Kevin Costner is a fucking legend.
Yeah.
He's an icon. Taylor Sheridan, for the most part, is not a household name.
Not yet.
You may not even realize all of the things that he has done that you're probably watching and you probably love, both movies and TV. But the thing is that he isn't a household name, despite the fact that his TV shows and movies are.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, David, moving on, let's talk about another film that's going to be coming out shortly here. And that is Mario Van Peebles' return to the Western.
And I'm so happy you're bringing this up.
Apparently it's already come out.
Yes.
But I have not seen it anywhere, so that's a shame. However, I still am excited to sit down and watch it once it's become available in digital or at least Blu-ray form. Mario Van Peebles returns to Outlaw Posse.
Yes.
The West becomes one in the new trailer for the unofficial sequel to the Mario Van Peebles Western. So Mario Van Peebles returns to the Western genre in a new project as a writer, director, and star. His new film looks to be an unofficial sequel to the 1993 film Posse.
Oh, it is. It is a sequel, Mike.
Posse is amazing.
Posse is amazing.
I, to this day, love that movie. Grew up watching that movie. It was on TV all the time in the summertime in the 90s when school's out. It was just on repeat, and me and my brother would just sit down and watch Mario Van Peebles just blasting people away.
And it's one of those movies that is such a great, like, if you wanted a Western that basically you could just sit down and watch repeatedly and just crack up at, like, the absurdity of it. Posse is it, dude. And it was, like, funny because, like, when I saw the trailer for Posse, or this upcoming movie, I was actually really intrigued. And then I watched it because they released a lot of clips online. So I just binge watched all of them. I'm like, oh my God. I don't want to say Mario Van Peebles has not learned since that movie first came out, but it looks like it's just shot the same damn way.
Yeah, have you not watched it yet?
I've watched the majority of it.
Okay, let's actually throw it on our list to cover this year. Most of the films we're going to be talking about today, we're going to be hopefully finding time on our schedule to cover, and Outlaw Posse is one of them. I don't expect a lot of great things from this movie, to be perfectly honest, but as long as we get like an old-fashioned blaxploitation type of Western, I would be okay with that, because that's what Posse was in a lot of ways.
Oh, heck yeah. And that's why I was really excited to see this when he released the trailer. And then what followed afterwards was, like, he would release like sporadic clips on his fan site and everything else of how, like, the movie was and what the plot could be about. And it is a absolute callback to black exploitation Westerns.
Okay, so as long as it knows what it wants to be and it's not trying to be something better than it actually is, no. I'm okay with movies that are like that. If you're trying to make a movie and it feels like you're trying to make something great and you just didn't have the skill set, or things just didn't come together like they needed to in order to make this movie work, then I usually snicker and criticize the film. But if you know what you're making and this is your intention, then I usually go in watching the movie when I want to review it with that eye.
What we should do, Mike, is actually watch Posse and do a Critique Revolve type of play it or slay it again, and then watch the sequel.
No, maybe.
Because, like, I want to actually see what you think, because you know what I think about, like, movies like that.
Maybe I'll watch it this weekend. It is available currently on Hoopla streaming service.
Yes.
Also available on Cinema Fandango, and you can rent it for $6.99 on your usual platforms, Apple TV, Amazon, Vudu, YouTube. So I'll probably check it out, add it to our list. David, also Calamity Jane, a new take on the Western icon. Currently, you're able to watch Calamity Jane, also streaming on Hoopla. It is also possible to buy Calamity Jane on YouTube and the usual platforms. So, David, Calamity Jane, starring the cast of CW's Arrow, which is very strange. But Stephen Amell, he's the man behind this film. I believe he has produced it and brought together Emily Bett Rickards, which was his co-star on Arrow.
Yes.
For many, many years, all 8 seasons of that CW series. But the series revolves around Stephen Amell, Emily Bett Rickards, Terry Miles, Tim Rosen, Priscilla Fala, Spencer Borgensen, and a whole gamut of others. I haven't heard much about this film. However, the initial reviews from various sites reflect a 4.5 rating, 4.5 star rating. I don't know if that is accurate or if these are just Stephen Amell fans, because Stephen Amell does have a very rabid fan base. Now, in defense of this CW cast, Stephen Amell is a very capable actor. He didn't belong in the CW. He was too good for the CW. And he also has a very deep knowledge and understanding of TV and film. So that does at least play into the fact, I should say that factors into my decision whether or not I'm going to watch this movie. But also the Calamity Jane mythos is interesting. The legend of Calamity Jane. So I'm definitely willing to cross out some time on my calendar and find time to watch this. Other than that, there really aren't any other big names attached to this film whatsoever. but we'll see. Now, I will say Stephen Amell plays Wild Bill.
Yes.
And that seems a little weird to me. He looks strange with the long hair. But again, I will give it a shot before I start shitting on it completely, Dave. I think that's the fair thing to do, especially when it comes to Westerns. I like to be fair. I like to give these movies a shot since we don't get a lot of them.
Yeah.
The next big one, David, that we have to talk about is The Dead Don't Hurt. Written and directed by the one and only Viggo Mortensen. David, this movie came out of nowhere for me. Like, I didn't even know this movie was being made. Have you heard about this film?
Yes, I actually heard about it since the Toronto Film Festival.
Okay, man, Shout Studios just doing it right. They unveiled the first trailer for The Dead Don't Hurt, the Western marking the sophomore feature of Viggo Mortensen, in which he stars alongside Vicky Creeps, announcing that the film will open nationwide on approximately 500 screens. That's decent. That's a decent size.
That's a decent size.
And it'll be releasing on May 31st. So just a couple months away. And again, just like with Horizon, go to the theater and see this. You already know this is going to be a quality picture because of Viggo Mortensen's involvement. I can't point to a single movie he's done that you can say that was a complete garbage film. So, marking Mortensen's follow-up to his father-son drama, Falling, The Dead Don't Hurt centers on Vivian, a fiercely independent woman who embarks... Ugh, that sounds so stupid. Can we, when we're describing like a woman who's not your traditional character that we see in female form on screen in years past, can we just remove fierce? It seems like every try-hard blogger, critic... when they're trying to describe a woman who is strong, they always throw in the adjective fiercely.
Yes.
Fierce. A fiercely independent woman who embarks on a relationship with Danish immigrant Holgen Olsen. I'm sure I didn't pronounce that correctly. After meeting Olsen in San Francisco, she agrees to travel with him to his home near the quiet town of Elk Flats, Nevada, where they started life together. The outbreak of the Civil War separates them when Olsen makes a fateful decision to fight for the Union. This leaves Vivian to fend for herself in a place controlled by corrupt Mayor Rudolph Schindler and his unscrupulous business partner, powerful rancher Alfred Jeffries. This is a very dynamic Western. It feels like it's reminiscent of the 1980s Western films that were very multi-layered. They weren't overly simplistic, and they veer into the historical epic at times.
Yes.
I'm not a big fan of the Westerns / historical epics. However, the way this is shot seems to keep it relatively small in its world building. And that's what will make it feel like a Western. Whenever you go super large, that's when it becomes an historical epic. And that tends to diminish its Western nuance, the things that make a Western, it dilutes it a bit, and then you're not quite sure what you're watching. Are you watching a true Western film, fully developed and immersed within the go-to Western genre conventions, or are we watching simply in a historical epic that doesn't really adhere to those particular genres that actually define and shape what a Western should be?
What I would tell you right away, because I know a little bit more details about The Dead Don't Hurt from... reading about it and from the Toronto Film Festival, without giving anything away, the one thing that everyone has stated, and I agree, when I found out like how the story is truly about, the story itself subverted everyone's expectations. Like, nobody realized the type of story that they were getting in The Dead Don't Hurt. And just reading about it.
Sounds exciting.
Yeah. When I read about it, I was like, oh man, I hope this comes out here, because you and me have to cover this, because like the way the story is told is, it sounded like something that I've never seen in a Western. And I don't want to give anything else away, because when it came out of the Toronto Film Festival, people were just talking and gabbing about this movie because of the story. They thought it was going to be one thing, and then it's something totally different.
Oh, that's great. I like that. Right.
I mean, and that's why I was like,
you can subvert expectations in this era of oversaturation.
Yeah. And a different type of Western. Like, I was really interested and hoping that this movie would be released here in the stateside, because it got released in Europe and everything. And it did very well in Toronto for the film festival. And just the fact that basically we have a Western out of a film festival that had people, like critics like me and you, mm-hmm. saying, leaving the screening and saying, I did not expect that movie and it was good. Like, just the way everything panned out. And I was like, okay, this is something that me and you have to look into, because this is going to tailor not just to us as Western fans, but it's going to tailor to us as filmmakers, because he toys with the narrative. He plays around with how a Western story should be told.
I've always been a huge fan of Viggo Mortensen's work.
Yeah, Viggo Mortensen's like, it's weird how he's attracted to like very strange projects, especially when it comes to the Western genre.
I totally dig his work. I don't think I've seen a movie. I'm sure there are movies out there that aren't so great with him in it, but every film I've seen starring Mortensen has always been fine. I've always enjoyed them. His last Western was Appaloosa, and I know that film was riddled with negative reviews, but I always... going to talk for a second. I'm losing my voice here. Well, I got to drink some water. I always felt like that movie was quite entertaining.
Yeah.
And it set out to accomplish exactly what that type of film set out to do.
Well, when you think of Viggo Mortensen's, his filmography and everything, a lot of like the times that he touches on the Westerns genre, like Appaloosa, I actually liked Appaloosa, especially like since he was playing opposite one of my favorite actors. Oh, I can't remember his name.
Ed Harris, Lance Hendrickson.
Ed Harris.
Yeah.
And he was playing opposite him. He's done very well. And then like another movie that he did that is kind of a Western, and I consider it a Western just because of like the stereotypes in it, is Hidalgo.
Oh yeah.
Hidalgo was a good movie when he goes into the West. And that's why I'm very interested, because now I can fully say this is probably his third time fully in the Western genre, that I would say, okay, is this going to be kind of like an Ethan Hawke type of thing?
Oh, yeah.
Where Ethan Hawke, I don't know what it is about the Western. Certain actors decide to get into the Western genre and they just knock it out of the park.
Yeah.
And they just become synonymous with it, like Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke recently, yeah. Definitely. The thing about Viggo that I've always said, he has such a great look to play a cowboy. He has that very, I don't want to say stereotypical, but he has that spaghetti Western European look to him. Like the role, even though he plays these white, well, I take that back. He plays a guy from Denmark, right? In this film.
Yeah.
So there's a European air to him that I think works in certain films. In fact, I've always said, David, that when we were talking about the potential Stephen King adaptation of The Dark Tower, I'd always said that the perfect Roland would be Viggo.
Yes. Yeah, 100% agree with you there.
He might be a little too old now, but in years past, when we first started this discussion on who should play Roland in the Dark Tower series, it was always Viggo for me.
Oh, yeah. When I think about it now, because I like Viggo Mortensen's work, I mean, one movie that comes to mind that basically just, I feel, shows the type of actor that he can be is like a movie like The Road, where it's that post-apocalyptic movie where he's doing a survival post-apocalyptic character and trying to save this child.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good movie.
That's a good movie.
And he has full frontal for you ladies and gentlemen out there that like penis.
Movie. Yes.
Full penis shot.
Yeah,
listen,
randomly.
If a director ever asked me to star in his movie and said, hey, listen, there's going to be full frontal. I'm like, nope. We'll pay you $50 million. No.
And Viggo's like, nah, that's okay. I'll whip it out.
Well, when you have a Viggo penis, I mean, I guess you... you have the confidence to whip it out.
But yeah, that's the thing about Viggo Mortensen that I'm like really intrigued what he does in the future, because like when you look at what he's done, of course, like Lord of the Rings and everything else. But
that's definitely his claim to fame.
That's his claim to fame. But you look at his filmography, dude, and it's so weird because he goes, number one, Green Book. I mean, remember that one. You get Eastern Promises, another good movie. History of Violence, that was a good movie. And then you have like The Road, you have Hidalgo. I forgot he was in G.I. Jane. but like Viggo Mortensen is like one of those actors I constantly feel like Ethan Hawke, where it's kind of like I'm waiting for them to just explode out into mass audiences and they become like Kevin Costner, where they become a legend. Where it's like people down the street, if I tell them, oh, Kevin Costner, oh, Dancing with Wolves. Yeah. That type of notoriety. Viggo's not there yet. Because I think he gets close because of Lord of the Rings. But if you ask mass audiences, probably is not that remembered as a legend.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. The next bit, and we're probably going to close out our show with this, is some news on the upcoming Kurt Sutter Netflix Western series that I have been waiting for now since it was announced almost 2 years ago now. And I'm just waiting on hands and knees for any information that they're willing to give us. In most of 2023, we didn't get much of anything because of the strikes. That's probably why a lot of the news surrounding this particular series has been very slow going. But we have been given some updates on Kurt Sutter's Netflix Western series, The Abandons. It has added 6 to its cast, which... if people are unaware, the main cast that is leading the show so far is Lena Headey. We all know who that is from Game of Thrones.
Yep.
As well as Gillian Anderson from X-Files fame and many other things. The official description of the series, which is relatively new, as a group of diverse outlier families pursue their manifest destiny in 1850s Oregon. I have to fucking say, dude, this is why I have full confidence in this series, because of Kurt Sutter's choice wording in the synopsis. Manifest destiny.
Manifest destiny
is a theoretical concept. Now, yes, it was an actual thing, but when it comes to film studies, there is an idea that has been centering around the idea of manifest destiny as a way to understand and get beneath the ideology of the early Western films. And the fact that he chose to put that specific word in or terminology into a synopsis shows you that there's something deep going on in this series already. He's going to be doing some deep dissections. And if you look at, first off, don't roll your eyes, people out there who are like, I just want something to watch. I don't want to overthink. don't worry. Kurt Sutter does that type of stuff. Yes. So for example, the first season of Sons of Anarchy, which was his show, is, for all intents and purposes, is a fucking Western through and through.
Oh, yeah.
If you break it down and analyze it, everything they put in there is something that's being taken from the Western genre. And that's why when people say, you know, when we have this discussion of contemporary Westerns, I typically point to Sons of Anarchy as being a perfect example. Of course, Yellowstone now as well is a perfect example of a contemporary Western. But prior to Yellowstone, it was always Sons of Anarchy and what they were doing over there, especially the first, I'd say, 2 to 3 seasons had a lot to do with, I should say, was built on the back of Western film theory and the ideas that many people have come up with throughout the years to analyze and try to understand the different forms of the Western genre.
Oh, yeah.
So as a group of diverse outlier families pursue their manifest destiny in 1850s Oregon, a corrupt force of wealth and power coveting their land tries to force them out. These abandoned souls, the kind of lost souls living on the fringe of society, unite their tribes to form a family and fight back. In this bloody process, justice is stretched beyond the boundaries of the law.
And that just sounds like, yeah, that's a Kurt Sutter project.
Now, we don't have a specific release date yet, David. However, as I mentioned, I believe last year when we first talked about this movie, this will be the first series that you and I return to I should say. Let me find a better way of phrasing that. We have pulled back on our episodic discussions on this network, mostly due to time and the fact that the entire internet is filled with people's discussions on episodes. It's completely fragmented, and it doesn't really serve us to do the amount of episodic breakdowns that we have done in years past across the board on our network. But this one right here, David, our listeners will see us returning to the episodic breakdowns for this particular series.
Yeah. And I believe that's going to be like a 10 episode series on Netflix.
And it's all going to be released at once, which I'm not a big fan of that, but we will take our time and we will release one new episode discussion every week is how we will do it.
Especially since, you know, anybody familiar with Kurt Sutter's projects knows that he packs a lot into each episode. So there's going to be a lot for us to digest with each episode, because like when I think of Kurt Sutter's projects that have always stuck to me, The Shield is always there. And of course, you know, you have, you know, Sons of Anarchy and the Mayans.
Mm-hmm.
All of those are so deep in the writing that he does for every episode.
Extremely deep.
Extremely deep. And you, each character seems like to get their own time in the sun, so to speak, in every series that he does. He's going to be doing this for 10 episodes on a Netflix show that's supposed to be bingeable. And you're going to be dealing with multiple characters. I mean, I think you just mentioned that they just announced like 6 other cast members in there, and you have 2 main. So that's 8 characters. And I'm like, this is gearing up like a Sutter project where each of these characters, I guarantee you, is going to have multiple, their own story arcs. And in 10 episodes, we're probably going to see like all of their story arcs play out together perfectly.
Yeah, David, I'm excited for this, for everything you just mentioned, because you are right. He does bring a lot of nuance to his character, to his characters, a lot. And he's one of the few, and I've said this on numerous shows, because I always use him as an example for, or I should say as a writer. I use him as an example as a writer that can write for an ensemble cast. Yeah. There are a lot of people out there that try to have 15 characters in a show and it never works out. The narrative ends up becoming fragmented. You don't quite understand fully what this character arc is doing and why it matters to the overall narrative. And also having that singular narrative strand that you should have there in order to bring all those characters together. That narrative strand just doesn't exist in many of these modern ensemble pieces.
Yeah.
But if you look at Kurt Sutter and what he does, his writing duties on The Shield, Sons of Anarchy, Maya, these are shows with more than 5 or 6 characters, sometimes 9 or 10 characters.
Yeah.
And yet, because he knows how to write a singular narrative thread or theme that serves as a foundation, he can always, by the time the series ends or the season ends, he can bring all of these arcs together to where they all were actually working in tandem to create this overall story.
I think that's why I'm also really excited when I first heard about this series, because everyone under the sun said that Sons of Anarchy was his masterpiece in doing that type of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I always feel when people say, oh, this is so-and-so's masterpiece, this is so-and-so's masterpiece, I always feel their next big project is going to be their masterpiece, because they take what they've learned from that and bring it to the next project. And I think that basically this could be if Sutter actually continues that trend, this could be better than Sons of Anarchy. And I like Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah. He also has a lot to prove, David, because if people don't know the background, how he got to be on Netflix, basically Netflix is picking up the scraps that Disney is leaving behind. Because the day Disney bought Fox, which included FX, which was Kurt Sutter's home for over 15 years. That's where he started his career.
Yes.
Within a week, they fired him. Within a week, they fired him because he lets the C-U-N-T words fly on social media. He's not a misogynist. He's actually a liberal, progressive dude, but he's like a moderate. And he also is a biker type of dude. He's a biker intellectual, which is weird, but okay. A biker intellectual. And the guy just talks like a normal dude.
Yeah.
He's extremely smart, but talks like the rest of us. And sometimes when you speak like the rest of us, you let the foul language fly. And Disney, for whatever reason, decides that they don't like that type of image on their company. So knowing that his relationship with them was already on borrowed time the moment they bought Fox, he decided to insert in the season two, I believe the first episode of season two, or in the Mayans' second season, he put some Disney joke where he was insulting Disney.
Yes.
They cut it from the episode.
Which was hilarious.
And fired him.
And fired him.
So he goes to Twitter, like a professional though, and he says, well, listen, did anyone actually think my relationship with them would ever last?
I know me and you talked about that in the past, and we're like, yeah, this is Kurt Sutter, and we're not surprised.
So he has a lot to prove, David. He's now on a new network for the first time in his career. And Netflix is going to benefit from someone who knows how to do shit.
Well, not only that, is kind of like, I think there's something to be said that I understand that big conglomerates and companies have to protect their image. But there's also some give in that where you have to take some of that if you want to gain some profits.
You know what? There's a terminology here that we hear a lot being thrown around in a lot of progressive circles, and it's diversity.
Diversity.
Well, you know, diversity is far more than simply what's between your legs and the color of your skin. There's also diversity of thought.
Yes.
And when you start trying to curb thoughts or actions or behavior that's not immoral, but just slightly different than yours, that's no longer diversity. That's the opposite of diversity.
Diversity.
And in my opinion, if you focus on diversity of thought, all the other areas of diversity will actually just find its way in. Diversity of thought is the key to true diversity in all categories. And Disney's play at trying to stifle someone's personality?
Yes.
It's kind of sickening. It kind of makes me sick a bit.
And it's one of those things that basically, you know, like.
So I'm hoping, let me just make my point, David, and then you can jump in. Sorry.
Yeah.
I just hope, my point is, I hope he gives them the fucking metaphorical middle finger.
Yes, I do too. Because like, to me, Kurt Sutter is kind of like Hunter S. Thompson.
Oh, there you go.
Where, you know, you don't have to agree with them, but it's their point of view. And that's what makes their stories so engaging, because it's so visceral, because it is what they feel. It is the truth behind them.
Yep.
And what we're seeing is that truth. If you're going to kind of cover up their truth, then, you know, that's the one thing that a lot of people feel, you know, is a problem with Disney sometimes, is, oh, they want to mask everything with the PR, and you know, everything has to be PG. Everything has to be PG. This is one of the times when you basically say that is a negative, where you basically say you're covering up a person's personality.
Yeah. David, you said it better than I could possibly say it. And that's probably the best thing that has been said on the show yet. So we should just end, because it's not going to get better than what you just said. I agree 100%. On that note, we do need to bring our show to an end. We will be putting out numerous reviews and analysis throughout the year. So be ready. I know we were only able to put out maybe 5 or 6 shows last year, but our goal is to increase that by at least 2 or 3 times, especially with all of the content that's coming out this year. It would be remiss of us not to. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Moore said he be taken from such prison to a suitable and convenient place of execution within said county, and there be hanged by the neck till he be dead, dead, dead. Now, do you have anything to say, young man?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. You can go to hell.